Welcome to PharmaTalk Radio. I'm Annalee Smith, producer of today's program and marketing manager of the Chief Medical Officer Summit. PharmaTalk Radio is a nonprofit program to disseminate helpful information to the life science and patient advocacy communities. Today's program is an excerpt from the 2016 CMO Summit keynote address. Dr. Akshay Vaishnaw, who serves as EVP of R&D and CMO at Alnylam Pharmaceuticals, tackles the challenges and opportunities in pursuing a new therapeutic modality from its inception. Today we're listening to the technology keynote address from the 2016 CMO Summit. Donald Jones, Chief Digital Officer at Scripps Institute, delivers an exciting talk on digital solutions impacting the economic efficacy of clinical trials.
I was asked to talk about technology on clinical trials, but I'm finding that increasingly difficult to do in isolation because what's actually happening is clinical technology is impacting the final products. So the notion of using technology in trials, making trials better, faster, cheaper, and the notion of using technology in products, making products better, faster, and in some cases cheaper, and then also extending into care and care management are all a big blur. And hopefully you'll see that in what I go through today. But essentially, when we sit down with firms, and whether it be in the biotech world or in the big pharma world, this notion of where things are going to end up, the conversation quickly goes end up. What are we going to do in the packaging? What are we going to do in the commercialization? What are we going to do in the actual care management in applied digital technologies? So hopefully you'll pick up on the themes as we go through here. So I come from Scripps. We're in La Jolla. Nice place to come from. I work with Eric Topol. I have the privilege of working with Eric for the last 8 years. We do genomics, and we have a clinical trials program focused exclusively on digital health. And digital health, for our purposes, is anything that supplies digital technology into the care and treatment of a patient. A lot of what we do is actually finding and working with metrics that will obviously impact whether you're doing a trial or monitoring metrics for the actual care and treatment, titration, therapy management, et cetera. A little bit of our history. We were founded in 2006. We're a CTSA site. We're the only non-academic center, CTSA site in the United States. We work with both sponsored trials and we do our own self-initiated trials. About a quarter to a third of our digital health trials are also genomic trials, so we blend the two areas quite often. This is just a infographic of kind of a lot of the sensors we work with from different parts of the body, but you know, essentially if it's a phenotype out there that you're used to measuring, there's probably a sensor for it. It may be in the form of a wearable. I'll show you lots of examples in terms of what we're working with, but there's quite a few sensors. We're starting to do comparisons between commercial sensors, sensors not actually even marketed for medical use, and those that are accepted in clinical trials. And I can tell you a little bit of insight, fast forward. Sensors worn on the body, even if they're not ever validated, they could be simple, literally sensors that cost less than $100, worn continuously over time, appear to be more reliable than some of the most expensive medical sensors. That's a little preview of where we're kind of going. And it really has to do with vast amounts of data over long periods of time turn out to have a higher degree of reliability. We publish a lot, and I'm just going to flash through these a lot, but this is just examples of some of our digital health publications, and so they're all available. And we focus on, can technology improve healthcare? We're a translational center, so we really try to go from the bench into clinical practice. And really the core notion is, can we change the value proposition? So whether that's the value proposition of conducting a trial or the value proposition of a product that's coming into or service that's coming into the market and healthcare or the actual care delivery, those are all elements that we're focused on. This was in today's paper, and this is a big part of what we're focused on when we're looking at to apply digital technology into healthcare, and that is as there's increased pressure around the world to tie the outcomes of drugs and pricing together for purchases, and this was just tied to Sanofi and Amgen drugs. But this process of thinking about how we're getting paid was probably first outlined by Chris Viehbacher, former CEO of Sanofi, who I think has done the best job so far as to answering the question, why should we apply digital technologies into pharma? And Chris said it very simply, in the future, we're going to get paid because we can prove that the drug we're offering is appropriate for that individual patient. Not for a population, for that individual patient. Secondly, we're getting paid because we're going to generate an outcome for that individual patient. And finally, we're going to get paid because we're going to get contract under risk agreements, like I just showed you happened today in the Wall Street Journal article. And what's coming? Well, I'm telling you, I'm working with companies in a couple areas that are coming that are kind of scary to folks, but one of them is microfinancing. The notion of getting a loan for your drug at the time you fill it up at the retail pharmacy. Now, why is that coming? 20% of the U.S. population has an individual deductible of almost $7,000 or a family deductible of over $14,000 against a median family household income of just over $50,000. That's why it's coming. Who's going to finance that? It's not going to be the banks. It's going to be pharma. Pharma is going to finance the microloan, just like they do now in terms of giving out coupons, et cetera. But there are actually multiple people working on that back-end system to provide that microloan. That's probably just a symptom of a much bigger problem. And as you think about the administrations over the next 4 to 8 years and the Accountable Care Act and what we're likely to see as a big failure, the amount of people that effectively now have catastrophic insurance and really don't have first-dollar coverage insurance is huge in the United States and going to get bigger. And so one of two industries is going to absorb it. The hospital industry, healthcare delivery systems that take on bundled payment, or the pharma industry having to absorb the first dollars because there won't be any dollars for them, and they'll have to only get the dollars once their insurance dollars become available. And then the second category that's being worked on, I'm giving you some things that are happening in the background, is virtual centers of excellence. What's a virtual centers of excellence? Centers of excellence, as you know from transplant, that's kind of where 30 years ago we said, listen, in order to get the outcome we want for the appropriate patient we want, we're going to actually pay a fixed price to a center in order to deliver a result. The results are going to be measurable. They're going to have to turn them in. If the results aren't good, we're going to fire that center. But if they're good, we're going to keep referring patients, and patients will travel to them. Well, what's a virtual center? A virtual center may mean that the patient doesn't have to travel, but they're still a managing center. Where might this first apply? High-cost oncology drugs. Why might this apply? Large Fortune 500 employers are really, really pissed. They're really pissed at large insurers who they feel have not done their job in managing costs down. And they're beginning to insist on centers of excellence concepts. It's already well, they've already advanced that concept for elective surgeries. There's 20 now Fortune 500 companies that have collectively aggregated a number of elective surgeries to 6 hospitals in the United States. Not 60, not 600, 6 hospitals for knees, joints, et cetera. They'll pay for the flights, they'll pay for the family, they'll pay for the hotels, et cetera. That's what's happening, and they're beginning to talk about, and the companies like Mercer and Watson are beginning to figure out how to design virtual centers of excellence. This is all going to have a huge impact on the pharmaceutical industry, which is going to impact the biotech industry. It's going to impact the biotech industry because the pharma industry is obviously where you float up to. And the pharma industry is going to be impacted because they're now going to be dealing with not hundreds of formularies, but tens of thousands. As risk gets pushed down, you end up with local formularies. The drugs have to meet those local formularies, and whether it's in a centers of excellence concept or just in a bundled payment down at local St. Mary's Hospital, it will be a local decision about what drug is in that package. So pharma has a lot of risk coming up into it, and that's why these notions of being able to add metrics to drugs are going to become so important, because you have to prove how the drug works or how acceptable it is for the patient. Really, the entire industry is in a probably a 10-year period of getting turned upside down in terms of what gets paid for and what doesn't. When we look at the pharma industry and ask the pharma industry itself, what do they think digitization is going to do? It's a little bit hard to see here, but you're going to see that they expect it to move from enhancing the value proposition to extending the value proposition to inventing value propositions. And so that's 2013, 2015, and 2020. on the slide. So Big Pharma thinks digitization's going to ultimately allow them to ultimately enhance the value propositions of the drugs they offer. This product was the one that probably made the biggest impact in my life in terms of figuring out what we could do with digitalization, and ultimately led to the $10 million tricorder XPRIZE that Qualcomm offered for making a device that can diagnose 15 different diagnoses in the hands of a consumer without any external help. And this product allows an ECG to be done on any smartphone. Just this week, a research report came out showing that it was as equal to or better than a traditional Holter monitor for managing AFib patients. But here, the reason why this product was so useful for me was a 15-year-old boy was able to take this product with a tachycardia event, one that he had had before, was able to call the ER before he arrived, get hold of an ER nurse, get her email address, send him his medical history, the ECG, based on Google Maps, tell him that he was 35 minutes out, and say, please have my adenosine IV ready when I arrive. And that 15-year-old boy was my son, who had received no instructions to do any of that. All he had was the device. We talked to the ER doc afterwards, head of cardiology at USC, and I called him, and we got the words out of our mouth that said, we're calling, and we didn't even get the word about it. He goes, oh, I know what you're calling about. He goes, that never happens. But it does happen when people are armed with the ability to get metrics, and they can figure out how to use the metrics in their care. So that's what led to the Tricorder X Prize. We put up $10 million at Qualcomm, plus another $10 million to run the prize process for $20 million. It's been going on. We had 134 submissions from around the world to develop a handheld device that makes diagnoses. We'll see the finals come out next January. But this is some of the examples of not necessarily the tricorders, but the kind of devices Qualcomm expected to get into the marketplace, that they expected could come into the marketplace, really effectively tricorders. This is a consumer device made to retail for $199 that measures SpO2, heart rate, respiratory rate, single lead ECG, and temperature, and a number of other things, used in 30 seconds pressed up to your temporal lobe for $199. We have this in a clinical trial now with 8,000 users. And interestingly enough, here's how they started using it in the last 10 months. Here's how they consistently use it. So the regular, what we can show here now is that there's a behavioral pattern that's of adoption that's actually occurred. They obviously get a little more excited up front and use it more often, but afterwards they do use it effectively every day. So an interesting piece, really an upgrade to mom's mercury thermometer, if you think about it. And the next version of it allows you to pee on it. So there's an accessory unit. And it's read by your phone. And this is just the beginning of a pattern of accessories and development of cheap, inexpensive medical diagnostic devices that can be paired with drugs, that can obviously be used without drugs together, that are starting to hit the market. We're also seeing it in the clothing industry, the apparel industry. One of the weird turns in my life is I started a couple of years ago sitting on a lot of boards, and one of the boards turned out to be the largest lingerie company in the world. It's kind of an interesting thing to be invited to. But the reason is because they're also the largest manufacturer of smart apparel. Turns out tight-fitting clothing and smart apparel go together. So that's why. You're going to see a number of examples. The one that I call out here in the bottom right-hand corner are little booties for newborns that measure heart rate and SpO2. You can put them on in the hospital, and you can send the patient home with mom, and mom can have the results on her phone. The nurses can have it on their phones or their iPads in the hospital. That's commercially available today. We're starting to see this clothing, and smart clothing, come about in all kinds of applications. You're going to recognize it in some of the big brands that you're familiar with. Right now, some of the brands are not as recognizable. Ohm Signal, Lumo, Athos are some of the brands that are out in the marketplace today with quite a few different sensors available in them. But as things come along, you're going to see brands like Lululemon, probably early this year, in the next few months, starting to bring their products out into the market. You'll see all of the major brands bringing electronics in. And the idea, for example, of sending an AF patient home with an ECG T-shirt or to asking them to go out and get one is actually going to be right around the corner. It's effectively here now. I actually have them. You just can't buy one quite yet, but they're coming. They're coming, coming quickly. And even the concept of wet electrodes moving to dry electrodes, moving to contactless vital signs, where you don't even need any contact with the skin to acquire the vital signs, is all right around the corner. We're currently working with a company now that's working with the seating industry for the auto industry, the commercial truck industry, and for the executive seating industry for companies like Steelcase, that's putting the technology to acquire vital signs into all of that seating. And the way of getting these signs is taking all kinds of shape. This is a Finnish company that makes a ring. So we're going to start to see the ability to acquire the vital signs and these other metrics in things that take the shape of jewelry, in addition to the clothing and other examples. And so we're going to see it meld into the background of everyday life. And what's going to be interesting for you in the medical world is patients are going to resist medical devices because they look like and smell like medical devices. They're going to want consumer devices. And the reality is, I think you're going to actually be able to use consumer devices much of the time. They're going to be either good enough or they're going to provide more information than you've ever had before. The market size of these devices is quite large. This is, breaks it down. But we expect the size of the market here to hit somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 million units in the not-so-distant future, just a few years. So this is a big area, and apparel is going to be a very, very part of it. Some of you may have seen this interesting case. A patient in AFib came into an ER, and they didn't know how long he was in AFib. So one of the docs noticed that he's wearing his Fitbit, so pull the Fitbit off and see when the heart rate went up. That's when they decided whether it was time to cardiovert or not. So this is actually the first reported case of using a $49 consumer device to decide whether or not to cardiovert a patient. One of many, I'm sure, that will come along. So in the backdrop of all of this, what else is going on? This is Eric Topol talking to Jim Cramer. Well, obviously, Wall Street and the venture capital and the public equity firms are taking a lot of interest. And why I'm pointing this out, and I'm just going to flash through here, there's tons of companies. There's over 5,000 digital health companies in the U.S. alone. Finland, little Finland, with 4.5 million people, has over 500. There's more money going into digital health this year than there is into biotech. The amount of investment over the last 6 years into digital health now is going to approximate about $30 billion. So, and we've seen big moves by the strategics as well as the venture capital firms into this area. And of course, we're starting to begin to see the exits, the IPOs, and the sales. But it's also impacting other large companies, big Fortune 500 that are moving into the healthcare field. And you've seen some of these names. Move into it. The one I would pay attention to, the one I think is doing the most interesting work that has the most potential to disrupt healthcare, is Apple. Not because of HealthKit, not because of CareKit, not because of ResearchKit. All of those would be relevant. But because of their connections to electronic health record systems, which right now are one way, sharing up will be reversed and they will be sucking down. And they will suck down your personal health, your medical information down to your phone. And you'll now be in control. Apple will say, we're not going to look at it. We're going to give you control of what you do with it. But we're going to open up the developer community to make apps that you can choose to share your information with. And in that world, Apple will develop a marketplace. Patients will be able to choose what to share it with. A lot of those apps early on will be very commercial in nature, like look at the drugs I'm on and find me cheaper sources for those drugs. But they will move into areas of evaluate my care, evaluate my doctor, look at my pharmaceuticals, find me generics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So watch what Apple does over the next few years. They're making the connections now. They've got them into Cerner and Epic and Athena Health, et cetera. They'll start sucking that down. It'll be interesting because pharma is going to be posed with questions they've never been posed before. You're going to be able to direct recruit, and patients are going to be able to bring their own medical records to your recruiting efforts. That'll just be one of the side effects of this. And they'll be able to pull them from multiple sources. So it'll have some benefits for pharma, especially on the recruiting side. We're seeing some of the big brands come in. Ralph Lauren Polo has a whole line of tech shirts. This one's commercial. There's a whole line of other things coming out. And this is one more example in the fabric space. But this arena has gotten so much attention. How many of you watch Silicon Valley, the HBO show? It's hilarious if you haven't watched it. It's a comedy, but there's so much truth in it. It's it's scary, but here's a little piece from it. Oh, do we have no sound?
Would you be interested in a device that links to your smartphone and lets you know even before it happens whether you're having a panic attack or a heart attack?
Yeah.
Okay, here's how Panic Attack works. You wear this on your finger all day and it tracks your vitals. Or, if that's too embarrassing, there's also a Bluetooth suppository, and that goes right where you think it goes. And that comes with a retrieval kit.
Okay, you know it's a thing if it's made it into Hollywood here. So, what's happening here? The Internet of Medical Things is being born. Just like the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is going to have 50 billion connected devices on it in 2020. 50 billion. There's only 8 billion people in the world, a little less. The Internet of Medical Things is being born. And as a result, we're starting to see a whole categories of things, one of which you may not even heard about, but it's the idea of smart packaging for drugs. And smart packaging is any way the drug is connected. That can be as simple as something you probably have all paid attention to, which is Proteus's little pill that goes in a chip. But most of it really has other more elegant ways of creating digitization of the packaging of the drug to either measure compliance, increase adherence to protocol, or collect additional information that's necessary. And it's given birth to some companies that are going directly at the trial space using digital technology. So I'm going to show two. Sangreen and Science 37 were both born to take the trial to the patient. Basically, to abandon the model of saying the patient has to go to the trial center and move it to a model where the trial can go to the patient. Now, obviously, that can't happen all the time. There's lots of reasons why it can't. You know them. But many of the times, it can. And this really goes to consumer convenience. And this actually does competing for patients using convenience as one of the reasons or ways to compete for them. So let's see here. These two companies were born in terms of providing, they're essentially CROs. They don't necessarily call themselves CROs, but they're CROs for purposes of managing the resources and mobilizing the resources to necessarily take them to the patients, get the data acquisition, put the patients through the various tests at home that can be done at home, et cetera, and manage that whole process so the patient doesn't necessarily have to travel. And a short little story about Science 37. Venture-backed company was born out of a CMO failure. I'm going to call it that, even though I'm in a room and might get something thrown at me. This was born at a trial that was trying to be done by Genentech. Genentech had an existing oncology drug that was being used off-label for a dermatology condition, and they wanted to go for the claims. The market size for this drug was very small, very, very rare case. In fact, the average patient saw 6 dermatologists before they got a diagnosis. So it was not even adequately, obviously, seen by most dermatologists. So the idea of finding the patients and then flying them to a PI site and then treating them with a drug that's an IV therapy for over the course of a year ain't going to happen. So how are they going to do a remote site? So we designed a protocol that said we're going to use everything but telemedicine. We're going to have a PI that does validation of the diagnosis. The community dermatologist will essentially be the primary trial site for the patient. And we designed an augmented reality app to replace calipers, because in this particular condition, there's a sea, kind of an island scene of lesions on the skin, and who knows whether the docs are actually measuring the same lesion anyway from time to time. So we decided, why don't we just take a picture and measure the entire lesion? And in doing so, we can measure it in 2D and 3D and collect a ton of data. So we created that app as well. Then we took it to the CMOs of the drug company that wants to sponsor the trial. And they said, no, we don't know about this telemedicine thing. Even though it's commercial, been in use for 20 years, we just don't know. So what was the solution? I was working with the staff, and I said, well, how about if we get 3 really important-sounding people come in and explain how useful telemedicine is? And they said, that sounds like a good idea. Who could you get? And I said, well, how about the Chief Medical Information Officer of the U.S. Army, the head of Connected Health from Harvard, and a guy who started 3 telemedicine dermatology companies, MD, PhD, all of which are dermatologists. None of them I have any clue what their credentials are in dermatology, but all of them have used telemedicine for decades. So that's what we did. We brought 3 of them in, spent a couple $100,000 to basically hit the CMOs up over the head with a 2x4 and said it would be okay to use telemedicine. So it's being done now. That trial's underway. I was a little amazed that that's what it took to get it going. I don't know how to undo kind of past practices and new practices, but that's what gave birth to a company, and that's what caused that notion of bringing those things to the patient is what allowed Science 37 to raise millions of venture capital dollars as a result of that request and that trial and that obstacle in terms of getting it started. So let me give you a little bit of insight in terms of what's happening in terms of digital packaging or smart packaging of pharmaceuticals at the pharma layer. So we're starting to see simple things like being able to read the packaging with your phone using augmented reality to find out more information about what's in the package. Pairs behind that. J&J is developing an entire platform for clinicians to be able to use to manage multiple drugs across multiple patient populations and mix in other consumer data, things like activity levels and other things that come from consumer activity monitors and consumer wearables as part of the equation. Novartis has many, many activities, one of which is something I was involved in, the formation of a $100 million digital health fund called DRX Capital in conjunction with Qualcomm. They've paired up with Qualcomm on using connected products as part of clinical trials. But what's not on the slide here and probably what's most interest is Qualcomm has a licensing program with the following offer to Big Pharma. The offer is, we will build the reference design for any electronics you want to go with your drug. That can be a patch that measures physiological output. It can be a drug delivery patch. It can be a drug injection system. It can be any combination of wireless technology, communications, and ASICs or chips that go together with a drug. We'll build it for free in exchange for long-term royalty, future royalty when it goes out. There's over two dozen projects underway at Qualcomm right now with pharma on that model alone right now today. So when I say you're going to be testing drugs with devices, I know you're going to be testing them because I already have seen the products. I know where they are in the pipeline. Pfizer is really big on apps, companion apps that go with drugs, sometimes as part of the label, many times as just part of the marketing. And Roche and Genentech really have done a lot more kind of experimentation around how to make clinical trials better, faster, cheaper using technology. There's one thing the industry needs. It's really kind of a master library of what's been validated. And there is some efforts around that concept that are getting started because right now most companies are reinventing the wheel over and over and over again. Merck's doing a lot of investing. I guess that's the common theme I'm seeing in digital health. That I would say there. And Sanofi is probably the most advanced I can tell in terms of really thinking about what's it going to take to make a digital product in the future. When Chris was the CEO at Sanofi, he actually put an edict out that said every product should have a digital strategy or an explanation why it doesn't have one. And that really carried all the way down to research. The head of R&D, global R&D, actually said at the molecule level, let's put a digital strategy together, even if it sits on a post-it, just kind of moves along the bench. But they actually started working along that kind of theory and process. And AstraZeneca is doing a lot with inhalers. There is a common theme with connected inhalers and data collecting inhalers where your time, dose, date is done, and there's quite a few companies working in that space. Even Teva and generics is working with connected inhalers as well as some of their connected products. One of the themes you're going to see is using electronics combined with generics in order to increase the value of the generic. Or you can think of it as increasing the price of the generic. And then Amgen's probably big on injectors. These are wearable injectors. So this is drug delivery in the form of a connected patch with radios and electronics in multiple forms. So those are just some of the things coming along. This is a physician perception map of how digital the different companies are based on physician perception at this point in time. Now, you can argue with where any particular company is on it easily, but this is a snapshot of how physicians perceive the pharmaceutical industry at this point. So let me switch gears and talk a little bit about what's happening as these things get connected and as digitization occurs, then what happens? Well, I'm going to give you an example from one of our research projects at Scripps, where we went to Sierra Leone, where 80% of the population in sub-Saharan Africa already has a phone. 80%. Here, the patient's being treated by the local town witch doctor, but all the people in the background have their phones out. little odd kind of scenario. But it was among this population that the U.S. Navy and the White House asked us to come up with a solution so that the healthcare workers, the doctors and nurses, et cetera, would not be exposed to Ebola with the Ebola crisis. And how would we monitor these patients for decompensation if we didn't touch them in order to get the vital signs? So we came up with a solution. Came up with a solution. You'll see the gowns on the left, which is the typical situation where the workers have to gown up. It takes about a half an hour to gown up, half an hour to gown down. You can wear them for 20 minutes because it's hot in order to protect yourself. And the solution on the right, which is a peel-and-stick Band-Aid that the patient stuck on themselves that then transmit to an iPad with 10 different vital signs, including single-lead ECG, SpO2, heart rate, respiratory rate, and a crude blood pressure at this point, temperature, et cetera. And then we get an output on a pad. Looks a lot like a monitor output, like you would expect. But that was too complicated. The Navy came and said, can you do something? You know, watching wavy lines, squiggly, hour after hour is kind of hard. And, you know, not all the nurses actually know what the squiggly lines actually mean in Sierra Leone. So could you do something different? We said, okay, good. We'll come up with a system a five-year-old can read. So we took all that data and plugged it into a GE aircraft jet engine analytics system and said, here's a system that looks at hundreds of sensors for an engine and establishes norms and non-norms. Then we put it into a system, created it so that it could predict decompensation. It predicts decompensation between 5 and 7 days before the medical models. And a five-year-old can read it. That's actually live system, up and running today in Sierra Leone. Still continues. We still continue to run that program. We're now running the same program for sleep apnea diagnosis in the United States. Again, using the analytics of norms and non-norms as opposed to medical models being the if I know A, B, and C, I can infer X, Y, and Z. Norms and non-norm industry machine model says, here's the norm for the machine, tell me when a non-norm is occurring, and highlight it and flash it, and then create correlations between multiple signal sources. So we're doing the same thing in the sleep apnea space. So once you start doing this, you can start building platforms. So some of you may know the company Dexcom makes continuous glucose monitors, little tiny patches, disposable. They go on your lower abdomen. They have a radio in them. It goes direct to your phone. That's a system. That's a system that goes to the FDA. Monitor, phone output. One of the things you should catch in that statement is, first medical device in the United States that half of the medical device, the phone, was never submitted to the FDA. Primary readout is the phone. There's no way to get the reading without the phone. How did they do that? The FDA blinked. That's how they did it. They did it actually because the parents caused it to blink. What happened actually was patients on the Dexcom system with a proprietary reader, who thought it was stupid to have a proprietary reader because it looked just like a phone and you had to now carry two display devices around, couldn't get the readings from their kids when the kids were asleep at night. So type 1 diabetics were downstairs. Mom and dad were upstairs. They're worried about their kids. They're still waking up every 2 hours to go check on them, make sure they're not becoming hypoglycemic because they can't get the reading because the proprietary reader only works within 6 feet. So what does mom and dad do? Well, being good electrical engineers, they hacked this medical device. They hacked it, got the signal out, got it up to their phone, put the programming out on open source data, gave it a name. And pretty soon, thousands of patients had a hacked medical device. The FDA got wind of this and went to Dexcom and said, you better put a stop to this, as you can imagine. Dexcom thought about it and said, we didn't do it, and these are our best customers, so we're not doing anything. Told the FDA, it's your problem, not ours. The parents went to the FDA and said, you can do what you want, but let you know that should you try and stop us, we're taking you to Congress and explaining how you're harming our kids. The reason you don't know that story is, guess what? It's under the rug. It's out there if you want to go look at it. You can find it easily enough, but it's not well talked about because it kind of broke protocol. But interestingly enough, when Dexcom went back and said, we now want to submit our device that goes direct to a phone, it went through FDA in 3 months after this. Literally between the time the parents took the FDA to tax and the 3 months. So there are some lessons learned about consumerism and the FDA. But here's what else is happening. Here's what's exciting. There's an entire ecosystem. Now, as a family of a type 1 diabetic, you can assemble your own erector set around your kid. For those of you old enough to know what an erector set is. You can take the Dexcom unit in the middle. You can tie it together with Tidepool software from a completely different company. Put it on your iPhone. Have it read on your Apple Watch. And then connect it to your Tandem pump. None of those things were submitted as a system. Those are all independent systems for the FDA. You can assemble this all today on your own as one interoperating system, as a platform. That's starting to look like a telephone, right? A cell phone with accessories. That's really the magic of what's starting to happen here, is we're starting to see electronically connectable platforms. They can share data. They can be cloud managed, et cetera, coming off of it. Same thing's happening in the inhaler space, where we're taking data from NOAA weather, getting pollen counts and pollution data, wind and rain and wind and all of the kind of things you get from NOAA, combining it with traffic data from Google and putting it together with inhaler use and creating something that goes real-time CDC-like data. And then we look at Philips with their new handheld Lumify ultrasound unit, which is cloud-based, that you can't buy. They won't sell it to you. You can only rent it. It's $199 a month. One of the cheapest ultrasounds now available, but completely in a format that allows you to share the features. In fact, you can actually share the ultrasounds back with the patient. So you can send mom home with an ultrasound if you want, an expectant mom, for example. So what else can we expect? Well, look at this fact. At 4:30 a.m. around the world, there's a million people looking for ear infection at Google at one time. So what do you expect to see? You expect to see an entrepreneur come up with a way to automatically diagnose ear infections. Why not capture that ear, take a picture, and get it diagnosed? Do you need a doctor to diagnose it? No. You can use computer and AI to diagnose the picture. Will that be acceptable in all countries? No, but it'll be acceptable in some. And this is one of the systems. This is the next system. TidoCare coming into the U.S. that also does the inner ear, that'll transmit the information, capture it, it'll diagnose it. It does heart sounds, it does lung sounds, it does single lead ECG, it does temperature, ECG, heart rate, SpO2, all for less than $200, all as an upgrade to mom's mercury thermometer. Some of our studies, this is what we call our draft study. We're looking for the genomic markers for atrial fibrillation. So this is a full sequence on AF patients, as well as they're wearing an ECG patch for a two-week period. This is a study we did with Deepak Chopra. We're in our third studies with Deepak. We're doing a lot around heart rate variability and meditation and its impact and stress. It's kind of a general area. We're doing it not only with Deepak, but also with the U.S. Navy. And this is an interesting trial in the sense that we did the trial with all the patients in the same room at the same time. The trial occurred over a one-week period, and they were wearing 13 different sensors during the trial. We have a follow-on trial, which is really cool for the control group, because control group goes to the spa for a week, literally, at La Costa, which is where his center is. The meditation group is actually the one that's being monitored. This is an interesting one on stress, just an example of we have many, many different trials around stress and heart rate variability around stress. But this one just shows how you use techniques of augmented reality and virtual reality to induce stress. And so in this particular example, we're actually using an attack on Fallujah as a stress. So this is use of virtual reality to induce situations of stress. And then we're using a lot of technologies to recruit patients. We do a lot of our trials with virtual recruiting of patients. We don't happen at our center to use CROs very much. I apologize for the CROs in the room, because we're trying to figure out how to take costs out. So we do a lot of essentially online kinds of recruiting. This particular trial happens to be another Genentech Roche trial where we're actually also proving whether patients can do their own at-home vision tests on their phone. And then there's validation with the patient's own ophthalmologist. This is a particular trial, interesting trial in the sense that it's very large. identification of patients for this trial is done by Aetna out of claims data. 300,000 patients are in the target population. These are patients suspected of AF but have not yet been diagnosed. They're recruited by Aetna. If they choose to participate, they get a recruiting package that they take to their cardiologist to recruit their cardiologist. And we give that cardiologist a little tiny extra incentive by offering the patient an alternative cardiologist if their cardiologist doesn't want to participate. Guess what that does for participation rates? Yeah, we play dirty. But it's interesting. So this trial will have when we're all said and done, about 3,000 patients in it. These patients will be sequenced, full genome sequence. They're wearing the iRhythm patch at two different periods, and they're wearing an activity monitor also at two different periods as part of this. And this particular trial is ultimately looking at two things. One of the things is looking at is cardiologist behavior. So actually this trial is as much about cardiologist behavior as it is about patients. But for the patient side, we're looking at therapeutic recommendations tied obviously to the genomic profiles and to the phenotype. So I'm going to flash through these quickly, but this entire trial is online. All the consenting is done online. They get all of the information through online videos and electronic consent processes. They get introduced to the wearables online. Everything comes to them by FedEx. There's the CRO role here is very different than what you would normally expect. This is essentially an internet trial. Notice there's no drug involved, so obviously there's a big difference than in a drug trial. So we have a very large industry here that's trying to figure out how to cut costs, how to make things more convenient. There's a lot of consumerism that's threaded through here, what's changing, and will impact all sectors of the healthcare industry. And I want you to think about that a lot, because as consumers become patients, they look back on their life as a consumer, they say, I can do this in my life as a consumer, why can't I do this in my life as a healthcare provider? The large drug companies are very concerned about this. I literally just had the board of directors of Sanofi and the senior executive committee for 3 days in Silicon Valley, specifically on consumerism and digital health, in terms of what does that mean for the industry? What do we have to do? What do we have to put in place? I spent time with me, with Eric Topol, at Google, and at UCSF and at Stanford in order to get that picture over a three-day period. So with that, I'd like to leave you with another video just to kind of cement that consumerism angle in place.
Ms. Kelly, the doctor will see you now.
Can you let the doctor know that I'll be with him shortly?
Huh?
I am getting a lot of work done. Your Wi-Fi is very fast.
But he's ready for you now.
I'll be with him as soon as I can.
Is she ready?
Not yet, but you're next.
For those of you who haven't read Eric's book, he didn't hire me to plug it, but it's a great overview of the areas of genomics and digital health and consumerism and what all of those means to all of healthcare. It's well-researched, really a textbook. I highly recommend it. If any of what I've said sounds interesting to you, thank you very much for the opportunity to kind of share what we're working on.
The Chief Medical Officer Summit is designed for CMOs and R&D leadership from small to mid-sized life science companies. The 5th annual CMO Summit will be held May 10th and 11th in Boston. For more information, visit www.theconferenceforum.org. Thanks for joining us, listeners.